This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the U.S. Defense Secretary meets with Saudi Arabia's king to discuss the Iran nuclear deal.
We really rolled up our sleeves on the topics that were discussed at the Camp David summit in May.
The man charged with shooting 9 African-American churchgoers in Charleston, South Carolina, will face hate crime charges. Nigeria marks a big victory over polio. One of Nashville music's power couples calls it quits. These stories and more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter was in Saudi Arabia Wednesday as part of the Obama administration's attempts to sell its Iran nuclear deal to skeptical allies. Secretary Carter met King Salman, Saudi Defense Minister Mohammed bin Salman, and other officials in Jeddah who expressed to him their approval of the deal with Tehran.
Both the king and the Minister of Defense reiterated their support for the Iranian nuclear deal. And then we went on to discover, as I said, other aspects of our concerns about Iran and also about ISIL.
Saudi officials had neither publicly condemned nor supported the Iranian pact in the weeks since it was announced. However, news accounts in recent days said Riyadh officials feared the pact would increase regional rival Iran's standing in the Mideast, further unsettling the volatile region as economic sanctions against Tehran are lifted in the coming months, giving it new cash reserves. Secretary Carter said the only concerns that Saudi leaders voiced about the deal centered on the ability of international inspectors to verify that Iran is living up to its agreement.
The only reservations that we discussed were ones that we thoroughly share, namely that we attend to verification of the agreement as it's implemented, and also with respect to the so-called snapback of sanctions. Actually, the king used that very phrase.
He said they also discussed the situation in Yemen, where Saudi Arabia has been leading a coalition carrying out airstrikes against Houthi rebels seeking to overthrow the government there.
And so the important thing from their point of view and our point of view, and this is what we share, is that it's what Yemen needs is a political settlement that allows peace to be restored and the people to begin once again to live in a decent way. Because right now, as you probably know, the humanitarian situation is really very tragic.
Defense Secretary Carter was in Saudi Arabia after earlier visits to Israel and Jordan to assure Mideast allies of continued American military support in the wake of the nuclear pact Tehran negotiated with the U.S., Britain, France, Germany, Russia, and China. We stay on the nuclear agreement now. International Edition's G. Abby Lee is in the studio to tell us about what the U.S. and Saudi officials are saying or not saying about the visit. Hello, G.
Hi, Ray. Like you just mentioned, the U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter is visiting Saudi Arabia and met with King Salman. The Defense Department tweeted earlier Wednesday, it wrote, in Jeddah, Secretary of Defense met with King Salman, Crown Prince, and Defense Minister to talk GCC security partnership, ISIL, and Iran. Those initials are referring to the Gulf Cooperation Council and the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. It's on Twitter at DPT of Defense, and Secretary Carter doesn't even have a Twitter account.
Well, that's curious. What about King Salman?
He is on Twitter at King Salman, that's King, S-A-L-M-A-N. But he hasn't tweeted since last Thursday. So both sides are definitely keeping quiet on the Iran deal on social media. However, there are a couple of things about King Salman's account that our listeners might find interesting. For one, he only tweets in Arabic. Two, he has more than 3 million followers, but doesn't follow anyone. Even President Barack Obama follows 67 people on Twitter, including First Lady Michelle Obama and the White House.
And speaking of which, tell us about the new Twitter account Mr. Obama is following.
Sure, it's the Iran Deal account at The Iran Deal. The White House launched it earlier this week to spread information about the nuclear agreement on Twitter. It's already getting a lot of attention with more than 12,000 followers.
I see. And what about any international perspective?
Let's check out what Israel had to say. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu tweeted Tuesday that we're told that the whole world supports the hashtag Iran deal. Sometimes the entire world can be wrong. That was retweeted nearly 400 times and marked as a favorite more than 200 times. Ray?
Thanks for the analysis, G. Social media reporter G. Abby Lee, and you can follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. That's spelled J-E-E-A-B-B-E-Y-L-E-E. And you can also comment on our website at www.voanews.com. This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. The man charged in last month's shooting deaths of 9 African-American churchgoers in Charleston, South Carolina, was indicted on federal hate crime charges. U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch announced Wednesday that a federal grand jury indicted 21-year-old shooting suspect Dylan Roof on 33 charges, including federal hate crimes and firearms charges.
The federal indictment returned today charges Roof with 9 murders and 3 attempted murders under the Matthew Shepard and James Byrd Hate Crimes Prevention Act. Roof is also charged with 9 murders and 3 attempted murders under a second federal hate crime statute that prohibits the use or threat of force to obstruct any person's free exercise of their religious beliefs.
Federal charges have been expected since Roof was arrested following the June 17 shootings at Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church in Charleston. Roof, who was white, appeared in photos waving Civil War-era Confederate flags, and survivors said he made racist remarks during the attack. Asked if the shooting constituted domestic terrorism, Attorney General Lynch said while there is no specific domestic terrorism statute, the Charleston shooting fits the definition of a hate crime.
We have here a defendant who was alleged to have harbored discriminatory views towards African Americans, to have sought out an African American house of worship, one that was particularly noted because of its age and significance, and he also sought out African American parishioners at worship, implicating several hate crime statutes. And we think that this is exactly the type of case that the federal hate crime statutes were in fact conceived of to cover.
The federal indictments are in addition to state murder and attempted murder charges. Roof could face life in prison or the death penalty if convicted. The Federal Bureau of Investigation says it is too soon to know if the gunman who shot and killed 5 service members last week at military sites in Chattanooga, Tennessee, was radicalized, saying that they are treating him as a homegrown extremist. The FBI says that authorities believe Mohammed Abdulaziz acted on his own when he attacked a military recruiting office and a Navy Marine Operations Center last week. 4 Marines and 1 sailor were killed in the attack. Abdulaziz was killed in a gunfight with local police. A new drug to treat Alzheimer's disease, which affects the brain and is eventually fatal, was announced by drug manufacturer Eli Lilly and Company. The new drug is called solanezumab. International Edition's Jeffrey Young spoke with Dr. Eric Siemers, who was closely involved with its development.
we have a drug, the name of which is solanezumab, that's currently in clinical trials, and we have generated what we think are some fairly promising results from those clinical trials. We presented results in late 2012 from studies that were called the Expedition and Expedition 2 studies, and now we have some additional data from people who finished the Expedition studies but then continued to receive the medication solanezumab. And so these additional data that we've found, we think really add to the promise that we first found at the end of 2012.
Up until now, have there been any drugs that were effective in treating Alzheimer's?
There are medications that are currently available that have a modest effect on the symptoms of Alzheimer's disease. But what we don't have are any kind of treatments that get at what we think is the underlying cause of Alzheimer's disease. In other words, the reason why brain cells die with this disorder. For solanezumab, based on the way it works, we think we're getting at the underlying cause of Alzheimer's disease.
It has been said numerous times that because of the size of the baby boomer population and worldwide, the number of people who are entering their 50s and their 60s, et cetera, that Alzheimer's is a growing and growing problem. Could you give me some illustration of how big a problem Alzheimer's is?
Well, as you say, it's a big problem now, and the problem will become huge if we don't do something about it. Currently in the United States, there's over 5 million people with Alzheimer's. Worldwide, there's over 30 million people with Alzheimer's disease. Those numbers will likely triple by the year 2050 if we don't find a way to delay the onset or even prevent the disease.
Dr. Eric Siemers of Eli Lilly and Company speaking with International Edition's Jeffrey Young. Nigeria is about to hit a major milestone. On Friday, it will mark 1 year since anyone in the country has had polio, the crippling disease that mainly affects children. Although a lot of work still needs to be done, this achievement for Nigeria impacts all of Africa and the rest of the world. Here's VOA's Carol Pearson.
Nigeria is the latest country to rid itself of the scourge of polio. Ellen Ogden works with USAID's polio eradication program.
They were the largest country in Africa that had ongoing cases.
Ogden says national pride, along with pressure from the international community and Nigerian health leaders, prompted the government to commit to eradicating polio. Getting all Nigerian children immunized was a huge challenge. It took the government, thousands of volunteers, and help from the World Health Organization, UNICEF, Rotary International, and others to get it done. They tracked nomadic tribes, immunized children in areas of conflict during lulls in fighting, worked with leaders who resisted immunization on political or religious grounds and for other reasons. Oyewale Tomori heads the Nigerian Academy of Science and chairs the country's Committee on Polio Eradication. He says education was the key in persuading people to let their children get immunized.
The people, once they realize what needs to be done, they actually go out and get it done.
But now, even more vigilance is needed, according to Carol Pandek with Rotary International, who spoke via Skype.
They need to continue to do high-quality immunization campaigns for the next several years. Also, have a very strong surveillance system.
That's because the virus can hide in people who don't get sick, but pass it on to others who do. Children need 6 doses of the oral vaccine to be protected from polio for life. While this achievement is a milestone for Nigeria, it's a fragile accomplishment. Nigeria has to stay polio-free for 3 years. If it does, Ellen Ogden says the virus will no longer exist in Africa.
We're trying to wipe it off the face of the earth and make sure that no one is able to come in contact with it and get paralyzed again.
Now the focus shifts to Afghanistan and Pakistan, the only two countries in the world that have active cases of polio. If these countries can immunize all of their children, the world will finally be polio-free. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
What is it like to study in the United States, and what do you have to do to get here? The Student Union is VOA's blog that follows students from all over the world as they face challenges and opportunities of studying at American universities. Log on at blogs.voanews.com/student-union.
Israeli environmentalists say a new Jerusalem nature park they recently created can help other cities and countries learn how to sustain wildlife in urban settings. Gazelle Valley Park opened in late March in the western part of Jerusalem, surrounded by residential neighborhoods and highways. It is home to endangered mountain gazelles, reptiles, and birds. Activists fought an almost two decades-long battle to establish it. The fight began with defeating a plan by property companies to redevelop the area. It ended with the activists securing municipal approval and funding to preserve the valley as a nature park. Amir Balaban of the Society for the Protection of Nature in Israel hopes Gazelle Valley Park will be a model for Israel and the world.
We have to enhance nature, and in order to do so, we're involved in a few very important stages. The first one is to create a national database of urban wildlife in all Israeli cities. The second one is to create master plans of urban wildlife sites and urban wildlife in cities all over Israel, and we're doing this in cooperation with the Ministry of Environment. The third aspect is the physical aspect, creating these natural anchors in each town, a network of urban wildlife sites that first of all protect local biodiversity, second enhance them and use the biodiversity services that they supply, and the third element is education and community, using nature to create strong community, healthy communities, people who care about their environment. So Gazelle Valley Park is the largest project that we have been involved in Israel's history. If this succeeds, there will be many more. If we fail, it might be the last one. Now, looking around us, there's a lot of urban wildlife in other countries around us. In Cairo, the magnificent Nile passes through Egypt's capital. In Baghdad, it's the Euphrates. It's an immense force. Now, we have a lot to benefit in these cities from wildlife and working with nature. And one of the amazing things we see here in Israel, and we'll see it when we walk and stroll in the park, you will see people from very different backgrounds spending time patiently in one place. You'll see ultra-religious people, and you'll see ultra-secular people and Arabs just enjoying nature, doing their own thing, but with a lot of patience. So maybe I'm naive, but I believe that nature is very soothing, and it's the best common denominator. And I'm not the only one. One of the first urban wildlife sites created in Israel, the Jerusalem Bird Observatory, which is by the Israeli parliament, held the first ringing course for Palestinian, Jordanian, and Israelis together. So there might be a startup here. And we did this with the help of Merck, USAID, which identified as a potentially powerful tool to bring people together and focus on the really important. So I'm a strong believer that it's not only an important thing for cities, it's very important for people in this region.
That was Israeli environmentalist Amir Balaban of the Society for the Protection of Nature in Israel. You can find a video version of this story on voanews.com, along with a more detailed web story about what makes the park unique. Click on the Middle East section of the site and look for the article titled Gazelle Valley Jerusalem Park Aims to Host Nature Coexistence. This is VOA News.
From science and technology, here's what's new.
What's new? A robotic bricklayer that its inventor says can place 1,000 bricks an hour. It's called Hadrian, yes, for the wall, and it's a big mobile platform stacked with bricks next to a huge cantilevered hydraulic arm that sprouts from the center of the platform, able to stretch a distance of 8.5 meters. Hadrian can work 24 hours a day, squirting mortar on bricks and placing them fast enough to build a moderately sized house every 2 days, or about 150 houses a year. This high-tech bricklayer, designed in Australia for a company called Fast Bricks Robotics, uses 3D designs of houses to program where all the bricks go before cutting and placing each of them. And the reach of the robotic arm means Hadrian doesn't have to be moved that often. The company says if Hadrian goes from a prototype to a commercially viable machine, the days of hand trowels and mortar-caked overalls may be over. I'm Todd Grosshans for VOA's What's New.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. American novelist E.L. Doctorow has died in New York at the age of 84 of complications from lung cancer. He was lauded for his reimagining of historical events, usually seen through the eyes of interesting fictional characters and some who actually lived. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with my colleague Susan Yockey about Doctorow and his importance in contemporary American literature.
He really invented a genre, sort of. He reimagined historical events through the eyes of these amazing characters that really, really made the reader feel like you knew them and you were actually there. And he interspersed it, interestingly, with actual historical characters. For example, in Ragtime, which he's most famous for, you meet, you know, Sigmund Freud, you meet Houdini, you meet all kinds of fascinating people, but you really get a feeling for what they are, well beyond the facts, which he, you know, played fast and loose with and sometimes actually got some criticism for. But he was a novelist, not an historian.
Well, what were some of the other titles?
Well, he was famous, for Ragtime. He was famous for Billy Bathgate, which was about Dutch Schultz and this boy that he hired as an errand boy when he was being put in prison almost for tax evasion. He also wrote a book called World's Fair, which is all about the 1939 World's Fair and America's entry into World War II and that whole era. And his most famous, I think, as a masterpiece was March, which was about General Sherman's march to Atlanta during the Civil War and really ended the Civil War, you know, after lots and lots of death and arson. That was really considered the climax of his career from a literary point of view.
I understand Doctorow was a real New Yorker, huh?
Yes, and New York was a character in his fiction. You could really feel like you sort of can sit down with New York and have a drink if you wanted to. He was born in the Bronx. He grew up in sort of the post-war era where there were lots of fascinating and brilliant emigres who had fled Europe during World War II. He actually got his literary start writing a story about a Carnegie Hall stage doorman that was going to be printed in his high school newspaper, but it turned out to be false. The guy never really lived. So he was controversial then. He became controversial later on, but I think everyone would agree that he was a giant literary voice of American letters.
VOA's Adam Phillips in New York speaking with International Edition Susan Yockey. They have won awards together. They help rescue animals together. They make beautiful music together. But now they are not together anymore. Country musicians Blake Shelton and Miranda Lambert have announced they are divorcing after 4 years of marriage. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with VOA's Country Hits USA host Nikki Strong about the breakup, which has left fans shocked and saddened.
They are country music's power couple, but now they're a couple no more. Blake Shelton and Miranda Lambert are calling it quits. Nikki, this is shocking.
Oh,
this news
goodness.
Has shocked country music fans.
Yes.
It shocked music fans in general.
Yeah, just say it ain't so. I mean, they seem like the perfect couple. They're winning awards together. They've written songs together. They've written songs for other people. Just they've always tweeted about their love for each other. So it came as a total surprise. But they did. They released a joint statement to the
right.
Associated Press.
Right.
And it officially said, "This is not the future we envisioned. And it is with heavy hearts that we move forward separately. We are real people with real lives. With real families, friends, and colleagues. Therefore, we kindly ask for privacy and compassion concerning this very personal matter."
Now, there's been a bunch, I don't want to report rumor.
Sure.
But there's been a bunch of theories,
yes,
let's say.
Speculation
yes. as to why. Because,
right.
as you said, these two people always seem to have the twinkle in their eye for one another.
Yes.
And now, boom, all of a sudden, it dropped like a bomb.
mine would be you.
There's been allegations of infidelity. There's
been
all kinds of stuff.
Yes. Now, I will say to their defense, ever since they were married, people were putting stuff out there. And they've been fighting up against that. But now that it's official, people are speculating all kinds of things. Chris Young was, Miranda has been accused of cheating on Blake twice, one with a gentleman who's not a star, and the other one is Chris Young. And even he took to Twitter and he said, no, I have nothing to do with this. I'm friends with both of these individuals and I love them both. And so it's been sad all around. The fact that people really, I really would like the press, you know, in general, to let them go ahead and heal and go through what it is that they need to go through. But people are determined to try to figure out why they broke up. And on one level, I understand it because everything seemed fine. But on another level, I think there's a lot of conjecture and a lot of lies that are being put out there. And only time will really tell. And I think after some time, when they're ready to talk about it, I think they both will be very honest and straightforward. I say listen to the music. A lot of it is in the music.
We wish them all the best. If you want to comment on this, you can send Nikki a tweet at @VOA_music. You can send one to me at @David_DBird or at @VOA_IE. And you can also listen for Nikki's show, Country Hits USA, at www.voanews.com.
That's it for this edition of International Edition. You can get more news and information on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
According to human rights organizations and Chinese activists, in recent weeks, Chinese authorities have systematically detained, arrested, subjected to forced disappearance, held incommunicado, or questioned and released 169 lawyers, legal staff, and activists involved in peacefully challenging official policies in China. Chinese authorities detained lawyers from several law firms, including six from the Beijing Feng Rei firm. The Feng Rei Law Firm handled a number of high-profile human rights cases, including the case of jailed Uyghur scholar Ilham Tohati. The crackdown began on July 9th when Feng Rei lawyer Wang Yu disappeared after alerting friends via a text message that her internet connection and electricity had been cut off and that people were trying to break into her home. Wang had represented several clients involved in human rights activism or religious freedom issues, including practitioners of Falun Gong, a religious group banned in China. The firm's director, Zhu Shifeng, was also detained. He had represented Zhang Miao, a Chinese journalist who'd reported on the Hong Kong democracy protests. Among those who have not been heard from since being detained is well-known lawyer Lu Heping. He represented fellow lawyer and blind activist Chen Guangcheng and helped victims of forced evictions. The United States is deeply concerned that the broad scope of China's new national security law is being used as a legal facade to commit human rights abuses. The U.S. strongly urges China to respect the rights of all its citizens and to release all those who have recently been detained for seeking to protect the rights of Chinese citizens.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at voanews.com/editorials. We'll be right back.
is for.